This is Get Lit with Literature, and this is Monk. Check out the website, allbook-books.com, and my Substack page, Musings from Between the Lines. You can find that via the home page on the website. So this book this week, it's not a thorough book review because I'm only into chapter 2, but I got so into it and I had nothing else specifically to talk about, so I want to mention it. It's a fascinating book. I first heard it mentioned by Stephen Newcomb, who I've interviewed before, and I cite a lot because his work is just so essential to what's going on in the world. His studies of the doctrine of Christian discovery and domination and dehumanization, going back to the papal bulls in the 1450s and onward, which goes back to Genesis, and basically the blueprint for the domination of the world and most of the problems today are rooted in that. So check out his work at originalfreenations.com, or his Substack is the Domination Chronicles, and his book Pagans in the Promised Land and his documentary film on the same topic with other people he works with too. And also to insert that Stephen Newcomb mentioned to me that the title is more apt as Ceremonies of Domination, as that ties in with his work. And when I looked up the word root of dominate, one of the things it says is coming from dem, D-E-M, the household, to build, or cathedral. So that obviously has a correspondence to what I'm going to talk about with the English building of houses. But also further, deeper, and more significant is the root domo, D-O-M-O, which has meanings of subdue, conquer, vanquish, and tame. So that too, as you hear the difference further on mentioned between wild and cultivated, there's the tame, and then all these ceremonies of domination that are in effect an attempt to subdue, an attempt to conquer, an attempt to vanquish not only the people, but the habitats and the so-called environment, polluted water, polluted earth and air. So that's what the effect of this, the system of domination is about. So that's why I'm mentioning all that, because it's this book is just ties right into that. It's called Ceremonies of Possession in Europe's Conquest of the New World, 1492 to 1640. And it's Cambridge University Press by Patricia Seed, 1995. And I was expecting a lot of dry information, but it's utterly fascinating. A lot of footnotes, like half the page is footnotes. And I want to just give the overview and then go into the first chapter. In the introduction, landing on the soil of the Bahamas on October 12th, 1492, Christopher Columbus planted the royal banners of the king and queen, Ferdinand and Isabel, and called upon members of his expedition to witness his solemn declarations instituting authority over the New World. Portuguese possession was initiated not by the dirt or earth below, but by the stars above. France, the French have processions and theatrical events, stage theatrical rituals. And the English, which I'll get into the first chapter, that'll talk about. And the Dutchmen drew intensely detailed maps scrutinizing harbors and coastlines as they disembarked. The Portuguese superimposed the grid of latitudes upon lands they were later to take by the sword. The English calmly laid out fences and hedges in the manner of their native shires. Through such activities, each power considered itself to be creating imperial authority over the Americas. So there's differences between how each people did what they did, but the net result is basically it's what they call black magic. There is a spell that has been cast upon this land and superimposed, and that is what needs to be unraveled. The consciousness has been swayed by all this stuff, and it's quite astounding. anecdotally, what got me to get the book, I had heard about the book a while ago, and then a neighbor across the street from me, friendly neighbor, we get along well, they have a beautiful spruce tree in the front yard, and I saw this long white pole lying on the grass, and I was like, oh, I think I know what's happening. And then the next day or so, the long white pole became vertical, much taller than the spruce tree, with the flag, a U.S. flag on it. And it made me think of the book, because they would not know, I'd bet you anything, they did not know that they were reenacting what this book talks about. Planting the royal banners of the king and queen. So they may not have that consciousness to them. It's, you know, happy to be in America and putting the flag up. But in essence, the sticking of the flag in the ground is sort of overriding, it's superimposing, it's transcending the quote natural authority of the earth, of Mother Earth, and superimposing a nationalistic authority. So instead of looking down at the earth and standing with the earth and relating with the earth, the flag pole is like a, it, aside from the height, one looks up to the flag. So it's like an attempt to transcend and get beyond caring for the earth. And that's proven out with the way, with, you know, a couple of the hundreds of years of history and what's happened to all the rivers polluted and the soil and much of the soil and such like. And I would think the book title could actually be more like Crimes of Possession or Ceremonial Crimes of Possession. But anyway, first chapter. Oh yeah, my idea I've had for a long time. I wrote an essay about it a long time ago. Is that each flag, each national flag, should have a picture of the earth on it. Even a small little picture of the earth in the corner. That would shift global consciousness, because then people would think of their country and they would think of the earth. Now this is a common thing. This is something I learned years ago. I don't necessarily do it a lot, but in some small way I do it in any kind of meditation or just thinking about things. One thinks about where one is and then expands it to your neighborhood, to your town. You start with your home, your family, your neighborhood, your town, your state, the country, the world, Mother Earth. So it's like this expanding consciousness that one does in a kind of contemplative way. And that's what putting the picture of the earth or a photo of the earth on each national flag would be, a way to encourage that. So I hope to see that someday. Now, just the other day, I was talking to my mechanic friend who has very insightful street smarts, talking about what business they were. They tore down some trees locally they're putting up a Chick-fil-A and a medical building, and they tore down some trees to do that, which I find, disturbing. But anyway, I was talking to the mechanic, and he said they're putting shit up everywhere. So, in not the most eloquent, but the most insightful way, he also is speaking of what this chapter speaks about. Because when the English pattern of getting here was not specifically to do to declare this and that. The Spanish had, that's their mode, is the declaration. They read the requirement.
So to insert another bit, looking online at Wikipedia, the Spanish requirement of 1513 requerimiento was a declaration by the Spanish monarchy written by the Council of Castile jurist Juan López de Palacios Rubios of Castile's divinely ordained right to take possession of the territories of the New World and to subjugate, exploit, and when necessary, to fight the native inhabitants. The declaration was made on behalf of Ferdinand II of Aragon and his daughter, the Queen Regnant Joanna of Castile. The requerimiento Spanish for requirement, as in demand, was read to Native Americans to inform them of Spain's right to conquest. The Spaniards thus considered those who resisted as defying God's plan, and so used Catholic theology to justify their conquest. Then it goes exactly back to what I mentioned with the papal bulls. 1452, Pope Nicholas V issued the papal bull, Dum Diversus, which legitimized the slave trade as, at least as a result of war. So this is what the system of domination is about.
Combination of the language and the legal law is another way that these things happened. There's an awful or great line in here, depending on your stance. The Queen of Castile, that language was the companion of empire. So that's part of what the book gets into, the way the different language was used. But the active language of the English when they landed was building fences, hedges, and dwelling places. Building houses and planting gardens. And the word plantation, think of slaves and stuff. This is all part of the colonization and possession by planting. If you look up the root of the word colonize and colony, it means to till, to cultivate, to till the land. So this is, and that's Cristobal Colon, the colonizer. This is exactly what they did. Fences, here's a quote, fences created the presumption of ownership in medieval English law. Their visible presence on the landscape physically indicated actual English occupation and communicated English rights. Furthermore, the fence kept cattle from destroying evidence of private property ownership, the act of possessing by planting. So this is not just an action, but it gets into English law and English rights. So if you just, you know, fast forward that to all the different, you know, legal stuff and property rights and this and that, property ownership, it's all bullshit. It's all based on these just, you know, random ceremonial things that have now become so entrenched that we barely think about it. But that's why I'm fascinated by this book. So in a way, it's the wild versus the cultivated, and that is part of. Here's a paragraph. As early as perhaps as the 8th century, Old English created the distinction between wild plants and those that were cultivated. Wild, in its broadest modern meaning, signifies everything that is unrestrained. People, feelings, animals, plants. When applied to an animal, wild signified neither tame nor domesticated. When applied to plants, it signified uncultivated. The Oxford English Dictionary traces both uses back to the 8th century. The pair of terms, wild, cultivated, thus signified a critical difference between savage, uncontrolled, and civilized. So there, right there, in a nutshell of the verbiage, is the essence of what's going on here with Turtle Island and the so-called United States of America. The original peoples were dubbed savage, and what came here was dubbed civilized. Now, this is the same kind of thing I read in the book about when the book came over to this country. And it was a matter of getting, it was like getting literal design to shift from the wilderness to, in essence, from the wilderness to the library and the book. And that kind of knowledge became the supreme authority, so to speak. So this is a key thing here, wild and cultivated. That sums up, this just sums up so much. So some more examples. You can't top this kind of pun. The British style of enacting authority involved gardens, or at least a garden variety imperialism. Garden variety imperialism. And another part of this whole process, the sort of active part, which goes back to Genesis and the Bible stuff, is that all of this was seen as improvement, replenishing, and subduing. Improvement, replenishing, subduing. So that was literally what they thought they were doing. Is as if the natural ways and the original people's ways for thousands and thousands and thousands of years was lacking and needing improvement, replenishing, and subduing. Well, the replenishing turned out to be, you know, destroying, and and such like. So anyway, so this the whole thing of the house and territory and law and settlements and habitations, the word habitation, a dwelling place, but habit, this became a habit. And this is what we, this is in part what we're living, this kind of system. And I especially think of this with Long Island to tie it to the present, and I guess any suburb, but this is what I'm most familiar with. Fences galore. Go out east to the Hamptons and the wealthier sections, and it's hedges. Hedges and some fences and gardening. I mean, it's not an absolute. I love to garden. I have potted plants on the patio, because when I first started gardening, I didn't have access to the backyard, so I would, you know, wherever I could do it. But that, it's like, you know, it's a wonderful way to connect with the natural world, and I love it. But when I step back and think about it en masse, it is there's this whole gardening business. So that has many layers, as I repeatedly say, the citizens of the U.S. were brainwashed into thinking that the dandelion, a medicine plant, needed to be eradicated. And so there was pesticides in the 50s and 60s, and now it's fast forward to people meticulously doing lawn care. But when you think about it, it's absurdly funny in a sad way. People buy soil and they buy the plants. So instead of learning what naturally grows, like if you let a backyard grow, there's a natural blend of wild flowers and different medicines that would grow. I've seen that here. I let a few patches go, and then I've got oregano coming out of the concrete. So stuff will grow, and there's a weed that it's called a weed, but I've seen the sparrows eat the flowers. So instead of letting things grow, you know, just wild and natural in that way, and saving money on buying soil and planting, bringing in outside flower, you know, what, bringing in other flowers and planting them as beautiful as they are, en masse, it's a huge industry in industrial gardening, imperialism, or whatever you want to call it. But that's become the programming and the patterning at the expense of getting to know the natural habitat. Now, on the other hand, there are, you know, the wild bird store will say these are the natural native species, meaning plants, that will attract butterflies and this and that. So it's not an absolute, but en masse, the consciousness has been swayed into you take care of your little garden, and that's nice, but that is in a way a ceremony of possession, because it reaffirms that that's your land and that's your house and on and on, that kind of programming, at the lack of consciousness of the bigger picture of with the earth and the bigger picture that it is being done on lands that were ceremonially and illegally taken. So that's the gist of what I wanted to get across and why I'm fascinated by this book. The second chapter, the French, gets into more of the pageantry, which I see again the parallel with the modern times and all the pomp and circumstance and Hollywood and theatrics and things like that. So by seeing these patterns, along with just, I find it utterly fascinating, by seeing these patterns, it helps to understand behaviors today, and that's one of the ways, as in any study of psychotherapy or whatever, by looking at the past and understanding where one's behaviors come from, one can see how one is being programmed and make a choice whether to change the patterns. So thanks for listening, and be well.